Last week we looked at two-thirds of Kohelet's PhD dissertation. Remember who Mr. Kohelet is? He's the preacher, someone who is presenting himself as Solomon of old, whether the book is actually written by Solomon or whether it's a sort of a historical memory of some of Solomon's thoughts isn't clear because Solomon himself is never named in the book. But he has been proposing and then carrying out a research program to try to find the source of satisfaction in life. He's trying to figure out where real contentment comes from. And he goes through three areas of life that we enumerated last week in an effort to find this satisfaction and assure himself that he's really got the best that he can get out of life. Remember the three areas that we talked about. The first was a lust of the flesh, sensual gratification. The second is the lust of the eyes, the desire to possess beautiful and valuable things. And the third is the pride of life, the desire to be so smart or so skillful that everybody thinks you're wonderful. And so you are prestigious and you look real good to those around you. These three terms come from 1 John chapter 2, where John uses them to describe all that is in the world. Kohelet's objective is to study everything that is under the sun, or everything that is under the heavens. So he and John have their attention focused on the same realm, this world. He's studying everything that happens here on this globe. He's not looking up into heaven at this point. He's trying to understand the things that people do in their daily lives on earth. These were the three areas in which Satan tempted Adam and Eve. These are the three areas in which Satan tempted the Lord Jesus Christ. And they're the three areas that Kohelet examines in trying to find the source of satisfaction in life. Now, last time, we looked at chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, his attempt to find satisfaction in the lust of the flesh. He expended great effort and a good deal of money in surrounding himself with beautiful gardens, attractive people, beautiful real estate. And at the end he said, you know, I'm so tired through all the work of doing this that it really isn't worth it. The exertion was more than the benefit. Verse 11, I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. So he did not find contentment in the lust of the flesh and seeking after physical gratification. Then, beginning in chapter 2, verse 12 of Ecclesiastes, I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. He tried to understand what wisdom could do. Now, wisdom is a great way to make other people think well of you. If you're wise, you always have the right answer, you're very skillful, people will look up to you. They will esteem you highly. And so, Mr. Preacher, Mr. Kohelet says, I'm going to look at wisdom. This is especially appropriate for Solomon to do because Solomon was the man to whom God gave a special gift of wisdom. So he looked into what wisdom could do, and he found that it could do many things, that it was a good thing to have, but it couldn't guarantee success. It couldn't guarantee happiness or contentment. Because there is this thing that we call chance. The unexpected things that happen in life. And those unexpected things happen to the wise man, they happen to the fool as well. So being wise doesn't guarantee contentment in life. It's a good thing to be wise, but it doesn't guarantee contentment. Now this week we want to look at the third of the three things that he studies, and that is the area of the lust of the eyes, the desire to possess things. This begins in verse 18, chapter 2, verse 18. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me, and who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool. Yet shall he have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored, and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. Therefore I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is in wisdom, and in knowledge, and in equity. Yet to a man that hath not labored therein shall he leave it for his portion. This also is vanity, and a great evil. For what hath man of all his labor, and of the vexation of his heart, wherein he hath labored under the sun? For all his days are sorrows, and his travail grief. Yea, his heart taketh not rest in the night. This is also vanity. There are three big ideas in this section right here. One big idea is the idea of hard labor, which is what you do if you want to get rich. At least that's what the world says. Go out there, work real hard, and someday you'll be wealthy. The next big idea here is that after you've done all this work and accumulated all this wealth, you will have to leave it to someone who is unworthy, someone who doesn't really deserve it or know how to handle it. And the third big idea here is the idea of despair. Discouragement over this state of affairs. Now, in fact, these don't come up in a serial form. They come in a rather complicated structure that I will not outline for you this morning. But let's just collect together the ideas on hard labor, first of all. This is that word that emphasizes the pain and the stress of work. There are three words that I found so far in this book that talk about the things we do in our daily lives. And we could translate them work, labor, and business or affair. Although I'm not sure that that's how the King James always translates them. Three different Hebrew words, though. This one emphasizes accomplishing something. It's work viewed with the product of the work, the outcome of the work. This work for labor is the one that we are involved with in this section, chapter 2, verses 18 to 23. And it describes the pain, the burden, the stress that comes along with your daily activity. And the last one, business, is, I like to spell it this way, busyness. Because it emphasizes that you're always busy, that you're always moving, you're always running in one direction or another, and you never hold still. These three words throughout this book give us three perspectives on the things that we do in the course of our lives. They are activities designed to produce some result, their work. They keep us busy. And they tend to lead to stress, strife, pain. That's a full three-word summary of all the things that we're about here. Well, he emphasizes the hard labor. Let's look in verse 18a. I hated all my labor that I had taken under the sun. The end of 19. All my labor wherein I have labored. The first part of verse 21. There is a man whose labor is in wisdom and in knowledge and in equity. Verses 22 and 23. What hath a man of all his labor and of the vexation of his heart? See how he sets these two alongside one another? Labor and vexation of heart. This hard labor really makes your heart sick. For all his days are sorrows, and his travail, labor again, is grief. So the first thing that characterizes this quest for wealth is a lot of stress. A lot of trouble comes out of it. I like that little phrase at the end of verse 23. His heart taketh not rest in the night. Even after he's got all this money, he stays awake at night worrying, is someone going to steal it? Have I got it safeguarded? Think of all the additional worries that you have when you're wealthy that you don't have if you're poor. So, the desire for riches brings hard labor. It also brings the dilemma of having to leave it to someone unworthy, because you can't live forever and you can't take it with you. So after you're gone, what happens to all that wealth that you've accumulated? Well, someone else will get it. And what kind of person will get it? Well, verse 19 raises the question, who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? He might be somebody completely irresponsible. Wouldn't that be a tragedy? To work and strive and labor in wisdom, in knowledge, in prudence, and then to leave it all to someone who just doesn't know up from down and just squanders it. That would be a disaster. But there's no way you can guard against that. In fact, to take matters a step further, look at the end of verse 21. I'll begin at the start of the verse. There is a man whose labor is in wisdom and in knowledge and in equity. Yet to a man that hath not labored therein shall he leave it for his portion. This also is vanity and a great evil. Kohelet says that to leave a lot of wealth to someone who has not worked for it is emptiness and a great evil. I think there's an important point here about the Bible's value system for us to recognize. The Bible does not consider wealth that comes for free to be a good thing. The Lord ordained that man should earn his bread by the sweat of his brow. And that's why Christians don't spend their time or their money gambling, hoping that if I just put a little bit of money in, I can get a lot out and not have to work for it. That the motive of the gambler is that I can get rich quick. I can get money without having to work for it. That's the same motive that lies behind stealing. The Bible is against that. The Bible says we're to earn our bread by hard work. And wealth that we don't work for, that's not right. That's inappropriate. It's not right for us to hope to enrich ourselves for free. It's not right for children to say, well, my parents are rich, so I don't have to worry about working and earning my living, because when they die, I'll have a big inheritance. That's not a godly attitude. The Bible says that for someone who has not labored to get all this wealth is a great evil. Just a little biblical perspective to tuck away in your mind. There's some of these things that you might miss as you read the Bible if you're not careful. But as a matter of fact, when the Bible says, thou shalt not steal, it teaches us that private property is an appropriate thing. And here, when it teaches us that it's evil for wealth to be left to someone who has not labored, it's also giving us a very important picture on how society should work. We should be careful that we recognize and that we preserve in our minds the notion that we have to work for our daily bread, not to be led astray by schemes that say, well, you can get rich quick, you can win the Reader's Digest sweepstakes, you never have to work again in your life. Well, this quest for wealth leads us to a lot of stress and hard labor. It leads to this dilemma of having to leave it to someone who is unworthy of it, so that all of our labor may be squandered. And the final result is an attitude of despair. That's highlighted in verse 20. Therefore I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. He just abandons himself. Nothing I can do. I've worked and I've worked and I've worked, and instead of finding contentment there, what have I found? Nothing but despair. Nothing but frustration. Cannot find contentment in that which he has accumulated. So the bottom line of this study, this mammoth dissertation that Kohelet has written, is that contentment is not to be found by gratifying fleshly lusts, sensual appetites. It's not to be found by wisdom, by making oneself especially smart, by becoming especially skillful. It's not to be found by being rich and having lots of money. Each of those things is a false hope. The best that can be said for any of them is that wisdom is good. It gives us light. It gives us guidance. But if we put our trust in wisdom, it's not going to deliver us from frustration. It's not going to bring us contentment. These things that are in the world, these things that are under the sun, they lead to disappointment and despair and the final conclusion that all is vanity and chasing after the breeze. Now that's the end of his dissertation. He's going to turn now, beginning in 2:24 and running through the end of chapter 3, to an exposition on the sovereignty of God. For the first time, we're going to turn our attention toward, away from the things that are under the sun, toward the God who rules in heaven. And the importance here is to show God's sovereignty in the cycles of life. We've seen a lot of frustration in the first two chapters. Now he wants to give us the key to understanding the world. To see this, we cannot restrict our attention anymore to things that are under the sun. Under the sun, there's no hope. We must look outside of the bounds of this creation. We must look out to the Creator. And then we can see hope. Then we can see a way to life and enjoyment. Now, I will tell you a bit about the structure of this section, because it's a very nice chiasm, and I can't let one of those pass away without putting it up here. Also, it'll help you to follow it as we go through. If you recognize the existence of these patterns, then you won't be confused when the theme seems to switch back and forth, as it so often does. The shape of the chiasm is like this. A, B, C, A, C, B, A. And so C goes with C, B goes with B, A goes with A, and as often happens in chiastic structures, the theme at the end is also repeated in the middle. When that happens, you can be sure what the author is emphasizing. You know the point he's trying to drive home. It's this A theme. Well, I'll put the paragraphs up here for you, and then we'll talk about them. Let's look first of all at the A sections. I'll read them by themselves. Verse 24, chapter 2, verse 24. There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw, that it was from the hand of God. For who can eat, or who else can hasten hereunto more than I? For God giveth to a man that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner he giveth travail to gather and to heap up, that he may give to him that is good before God. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. That sounds like a refreshing change from all the things that we've been reading, doesn't it? Nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and make his soul enjoy good in his labor. Chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. And again, 3:22. Wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. For who shall bring him to see that what shall be after him? So if we were to put a label on the A sections, it would be that we have here an exhortation from Kohelet to enjoy life. Enjoy life. Eat. Drink. Enjoy good in your labor. Rejoice. Be happy. Let's take a look now at the C sections. The correspondence between them is also pretty easy to see. Both of these have to do with the idea that men are frustrated and that God himself has caused that frustration. Verse 9, chapter 3. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? Well, we know the answer to that. The first two chapters have proved to us that there is no profit for a man in that in which he labors. I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. This is that perpetual quest that God has set man on, this longing that man has in his heart to understand the creation around him, and yet the basic inability to understand it, so that he's always frustrated. And God has given him this travail. We see the same idea down in verses 14 and 15. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it that men should fear before him. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been, and God requireth that which is past. God is absolutely in control of the affairs of men, and that means that when he does something, there's no way man can change it. He does this so that man should fear before him. He set the world up in this way to frustrate man's ambition, to prove to him that he must look beyond himself to a God in heaven. So let's call these sections God-given frustration. Those are the C sections. Now, the B sections are a little bit harder to see the connection between them. The first eight verses are perhaps the most famous part of this book. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted. You've heard those many times. There's even a popular song that's based upon them. But if you look down in verse 17, which is in the other B section down here, I said in mine heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and every work. These two sections disabuse us of the notion that God is vanilla. Sometimes you'll hear people say, if there really is a God in heaven, why does he allow sorrow and suffering on earth? Why doesn't he make life happy all the time? You ever heard that from somebody? I remember when I was in high school, I was a believer. Became a believer at the age of 11 by God's grace. And I, when I was in high school, I was interviewed by one of the newspapers because I was in the science class and I was going to a big university, and this was a small town, so they wanted to find out all about this wonderful high school student. So the Philadelphia newspaper interviewed me. We were over in New Jersey, published it in the Sunday paper, my picture there with my slide rule, and it really looked neat. But in the interview, it came out that I was a believer in Jesus Christ, and I said so, and they put that in the paper. I remember I got a letter back from somebody down by the seashore, somewhere down in Cape May or Absecon or one of the coastside towns in New Jersey, who had read this article in the Philadelphia, I guess it was the Inquirer. And his letter was to the effect that there couldn't possibly be a God, and anybody with any sense in his head could see that, because if there were a God, he wouldn't let there be things like rattlesnakes and mosquitoes and bumblebees in this world. That was his level of theological sophistication. How could there possibly be a God in heaven when there's poison ivy and weeds, you know? Ecclesiastes, in these sections here, is addressing that problem. He's saying there is a time and a season for everything. God has structured the world in such a way that both life and death are appropriate, and both of them fit into his plan. Both war and peace are part of the overarching structure that he has constructed. He is what I've called him here, the God of the extremes. Let's put that up, shall we? Or the opposites, maybe. When you're talking about God, you're not allowed to say, well, it's all simple. He does things like this, and I've got it all wrapped up and folded up in a nice, neat package. He only allows good. He never allows evil. Nope, you can't say that. Maybe you can, if you're a theologian sitting in an ivory tower. But remember, Qohelet is brutally honest. He lives where we live, day to day, in the world. And he says, wake up, folks. There is sorrow, there is misery, there is frustration. We saw that in the first two chapters. Now in chapter 3, God is in control of the sorrow and the misery and the frustration. He has put it in its own time. He has put it in its own place, and it serves a purpose there. Don't be so simple-minded as to think that that disproves the existence of God, or that somehow his hands are tied and he's being frustrated. All those things fit into his plan. The problem is that you're too simple-minded to see how complex it all is. So this is his essay now on the sovereignty of God. After studying the frustration of daily life, the impossibility of finding satisfaction under the sun, he turns his eyes toward the heavens, and he shows us a God who is big enough and complex enough to explain not only the happy things, but also the sad things. A God who sometimes gives us frustrations to keep us in our place, to turn us in fear toward himself, and a God whose ultimate desire for us is that we should enjoy the life he gives us. Now, with that outline, let's begin to work our way through this passage. And we'll start at the beginning. We'll go through these in sequence. So we'll come back to themes repeatedly. I think in this case it's a complex enough passage that this is a better approach than taking all the A's together and then all the B's and then all the C's. We'll just work through in series, but we'll keep this before us so that we can see the ideas developing as we go. So we begin with verses 24 through 26. Enjoy life. First of all, I have to call your attention to some italics in this verse. Our authorized version reads, as does every other English version that I know of, there is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and make his soul enjoy good in his labor. As a matter of fact, the Hebrew says, it is not good for a man that he should eat and drink and make his soul enjoy good in his labor. It says what looks like exactly the opposite. Now, given what we've read in the first two chapters, that wouldn't be surprising. But given what we read down in verses 12 and 13, and in chapter 3, verse 22, and in chapter 5, and in chapter 8, and in chapter 9, and in chapter 11, where this same theme keeps coming up, it would be very strange for him to start off this way. Most people who deal with this passage, the reason I'm going into this is that I spent 4 hours yesterday on this, so you've got to suffer through it with me. The Hebrew text looks something like this. There is nothing good for a man that, this is a SH sound, in fact I'll just make it a SH, that he eat. It's not good for a man, this is the word for, a man, that he eat. What you've got translated here is the phrase, there is nothing good for a man than that he eat. Just one letter makes the difference between saying it's not good for a man to enjoy life and the only thing good for a man is to enjoy life. That one little letter. So most of the translations assume that this got dropped out. And that wouldn't be a hard thing to do when you've got two letters together like this that are the same. It's very easy. Remember, these things were all copied by hand. It's very easy for a scribe to drop out one of those letters. And that's the solution that everybody takes, including the King James. But I was curious to see whether I couldn't find some other way around it. And after comparing all the passages over and over, I'm going to take that out. And I'm just going to split the sentence right here. You see, his first statement is a very bald summary of what we've seen in the first two chapters. There is nothing good in man. This is translated for in your King James. It's actually the Hebrew preposition that means in. There's another preposition that means for. That's not the one he uses. There is nothing good in man, period. Man, by his own efforts, by his own labors, can't find anything. So that's his first statement here. His second statement takes us to the end of verse 24. That he should eat and drink and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor, this also I saw that it was from the hand of God. The fact that man can eat and drink and enjoy good in his labor is not something that comes from within man himself, because in man is nothing. And that's not new either, is it? What did the Apostle Paul say? I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. In fact, I didn't write that in my notes, but I'm going to have to add that because that's a perfect parallel. That's Romans 7. There's nothing good in man. The fact that he can't enjoy life at all is something that God has given him. It is from the hand of God. Every time you hear an unbeliever laugh, you are seeing a crack in the fall. Every time you see an unbeliever smile, you are seeing something that, strictly speaking, ought not to be there, given the effect of sin on our race. You are seeing something that will not be there at all in hell. Because in man, there is nothing good. In man, there is no pleasure. In man, there is no satisfaction. None. And the fact that unbelievers can smile or laugh or feel pleasure at all is something that comes to them, Kohelet says, from the hand of God. That is God's intervention in their lives. This is a very much a New Testament concept. Look at Matthew chapter 5, verse 45. Matthew 5, 45. I'll start with verse 44. I say unto you, this is the Lord Jesus speaking, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. Be pleasant to those who abuse you, because even God gives pleasant things to those who sin against him. He makes the sun to rise not only for the good people, the evil people enjoy the sun too. He sends rain to cause the crops to grow, not just for the righteous, but also for the wicked. And you get the same sentiment in Acts chapter 14, verse 17, where Paul is preaching in the area of Lystra, Derbe. Acts chapter 14, verse 17 tells us that God left not himself without a witness, in that he did good and gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. That's God's witness to the world. Men by their sin have buried themselves in wickedness, in sorrow, in sadness. In a way, that's what this book of Kohelet is all about. It's about the fall, the effects of Adam's fall on the human race. Now here he is saying that the only reason people are not as miserable as they could be is that God put some good into their lives, put some happiness there. Paul says it's for a witness of himself, to show that he is there. Now some people see that witness and they respond, and they trust in God. They become believers. Other people see that good and they reject it. I'm not saying they reject the good. They take it, they enjoy it, but they don't thank God for it. Paul in Romans chapter 1 condemns the unbeliever. Why? What's the first thing the unbeliever is guilty for? Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and they changed the glory of the incorruptible God into the likeness of corruptible things. The first fundamental sin of man is unthankfulness. After God has given him all these good things, in spite of his sin, given him these blessings, given him the ability to eat and to drink and to enjoy life, he doesn't thank God for it. And so that which leads some toward salvation for others becomes a seal to their doom, because it is the occasion by which they reject God's sovereignty in their lives, and as a consequence, their judgment is greater, their damnation even more sure. Well, Solomon says, look, there's nothing good in man. Man himself can never generate satisfaction. I just proved that. I wrote a PhD dissertation on this. Boy, it can't tell me anything. Nothing good for man. The fact that he can eat and that he can drink and that he can enjoy good, that comes from the hand of God. And verse 25, who is saying this? This sounds very, very theological. In fact, I expect that Francis afterwards will want to remind me of the common grace debate and a lot of the intricacies of thought that this kind of thing gets into. This is very sophisticated theology that we're talking about here. You might think this is some theologian sitting up on his throne in a seminary somewhere. No, says Solomon, listen. Who can eat, or who else can... The Hebrew word means enjoy. Who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? If there is anybody that ought to know the capacity of man in his own effort to have a good time, I ought to be the one. Remember back to chapter 2 and all those fantastic things that I did, those pleasure palaces I built for myself? If anybody could find satisfaction in the things of life, I'm the one. I tried. And I'm the one who's telling you that in man there is nothing good. that the ability to enjoy, the ability to eat and to drink, that comes from the hand of God. It is His gift. In fact, there is a moral distinction. Verse 26, God giveth to a man that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner he giveth travail, to gather and to heap up, that he may give to him that is good before God. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. God treats the righteous and the sinner differently. To the righteous he gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy. Go back and look at verse 21. Back in the frustration portion of this book, there is a man whose labor is in wisdom and in knowledge and in equity, says our version. The Hebrew word actually means skill that leads to success and prosperity. There is a man who labors in wisdom and knowledge and in skill directed toward prosperity. That's vanity and a great evil, that he has to leave all that he's earned to someone who comes after him and has not worked for it. Well, it doesn't say in verse 26 that God gives the righteous wisdom and knowledge and skill that leads to prosperity. That's not the promise. In fact, there are many of God's people who are not prosperous in the world's terms. But God does promise to give to him who is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy. Isn't that a lovely thing? God never promises to make his people rich, but he does promise to make them joyful. And you might say, well, phooey, if I had the riches, I would be joyful. I'd rather he make me rich. But you're forgetting the first two chapters. Riches don't bring joy. That's the whole point. The world's way is to go after wisdom and knowledge and riches. God won't guarantee you that if you follow him. But he does promise to give you, if you're good in his sight, wisdom and knowledge and joy. Remember that joy is something you can have even in the midst of tears. The book in the New Testament that has the most to say about joy is the book of Philippians, which Paul wrote while he was in Roman jail. He was imprisoned. And remember that Roman jails were not the kind of taxpayer-supported hotels that we run today. Roman jails were stone-lined pits in the earth, filled with sewage. You were thrown in there and left. If you had some friends to bring you food, you might get something to eat. If you didn't, you would starve, and who cared? And there was no dispensary, no medical aid, no clean sheets every other Tuesday. It was in that kind of an environment that Paul had the most to say about joy in all of his letters in the New Testament. Yes, God will give. This is a promise. You can count on this. God will give him that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he will give exactly what we have learned to expect through the first two chapters of the book: travail and sorrow. And it's this course that the sinner follows on that is vanity and vexation of spirit. So there is something for us to live for. It's enjoyment in our daily activities. The joy of eating and drinking, sitting around the supper table and having a good laugh with the members of the family. Enjoying good in our labor. More to say about that later. But there are still these perplexing opposites in our world. There are these things that don't seem to fit. If there really were a God in heaven, why isn't everything nice and neat and clean? Well, the world is neither black nor white. We know this. It is not all sadness, nor is it all happiness. It is fallen, but God still gives grace. It is redeemed, but it still shows suffering. This distinction, which grows out of the sinner-righteous distinction in verse 26, we find expounded here in the first part of chapter 3 with 14 pairs of opposites, each of which is said to have its appropriate time in our world. Everything that happens is a time where it fits. As Kohelet will say in verse 11, God has made everything beautiful in its time. Not his time, but its time. Everything fits in God's great plan. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under heaven. Now each of these verses consists of two contrasts, and each verse focuses on a different theme. The first verse focuses on the theme of life and death. There is a time literally to give birth and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted. Life and death both fit in God's scheme. You say, well, he didn't make the world with death. Death came with sin. That's right, but think, if you will, of the grace of God in death. Think of the consequences if Adam and Eve had been allowed to live forever in their sin. Wouldn't that have been a terrible thing? Given the rebellion of mankind, the sin that's in the world, death actually has a very important contribution to make. It sets us free from this world of suffering. Verse 3 emphasizes construction and destruction. There is a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up. Both of those fit. It's not only the constructive things in the world that are part of God's plan, but also the destructive things. They fit too. Earthquakes and tornadoes and volcanoes, those fit in God's plan. There is a time to break down, a time to kill, as well as a time to build up and a time to heal. Verse 4 contrasts joy and sorrow, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. I remember a little snippet of a poem that a friend of mine wrote many years ago, a pastor in California, describing God as a weaver sitting at a loom. And the little snippet of the poem that I remember goes like this. The dark threads are as needful in the weaver's skillful hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern he has planned. Not until the loom is silent and the shuttles cease to fly shall God unfold the pattern, and we'll see the reason why. You know, when you weave something on a loom, you can't see the pattern. I don't know if you knew that or not. When you're weaving at a loom, the pattern's underneath. You work from the back. And the weaver has to have the pattern all in his or her head, and it's all she can never see it. I mean, you're working on the back of it all the time, and all you can see is little loose ends of thread and random patterns. It doesn't make any sense. Then when you're done, you unroll this tapestry and turn it over, and there is a beautiful picture that has been uncovered. Well, to make a beautiful picture, you have to have dark colors as well as light ones. And that's the sense in which Kohelet is telling us here. There's a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time for sadness, as well as a time for happiness. Verse 5, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A verse that emphasizes place for conjugal love and a place for abstention. Verse 5, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away. Here's profit and loss. I wonder how many people last October when the market went down were thinking in terms of verse 6 here. There are times when it's God's purpose for his people to lose financially, materially. And there are times when it's in his purpose for them to gain. Wealth in itself is not wrong. It's the love of money that is the root of all kinds of evil.